This is 2011, the year in review from Brownfield Ag News. I'm Tom Stever. Ratification was a long time in coming. 2011 is known for the year when free trade agreements with Colombia, Panama, and South Korea were passed and signed. Years of lobbying both for and against the agreements preceded their actual passage. Here's more from Brownfield's Julie Harker.
In late August, Colombia's ambassador to the White House, Gabriel Silva, met with farmer leaders, labor leaders, and local governments in several U.S. states to push for ratification of the pending free trade agreement. Silva, a farmer himself, told Brownfield he relates to U.S. farmers' frustrations.
The delay in the FTA and having it approved is clearly destroying jobs in America and affecting, most of all, American farmers.
U.S. wheat growers were among those very concerned with the recent implementation of Colombia's FTA with Canada, not to mention those free trade agreements it had with other South American countries and the European Union. Silva said the 46% market share U.S. farmers had in 2008 had dwindled to less than half of that, so urgency was needed to pass the U.S.-Colombia FTA before it got bogged down in an election year. As for human rights concerns, Silva said Colombia was moving beyond its violent past. He said Colombia's President Santos and President Obama had reached agreements to help protect labor leaders and small farmers in Colombia.
Passage of the free trade agreements came in October. The agreements lower and remove many of the tariffs that currently slow trade between the three countries. During floor debate prior to passage, Republican John Thune of South Dakota said the agreements will benefit the U.S. economy.
At a time when we need to focus our efforts on measures that will promote economic growth and job creation, these agreements are exactly the type of legislation that we ought to be considering.
But that feeling was not universal. Ohio Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown compared the pending free trade agreements with what he says are the failings of pacts such as the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA.
We may sell some more things, but we're buying a lot more things from these other countries because the trade agreements simply aren't working.
In several states, farmers were concerned by activists who hold sway at the ballot boxes. The fear is that attempts by organizations such as the Humane Society of the United States to change laws state by state may turn into restrictions on livestock productions that make that type of agriculture impossible. The Missouri legislature in 2011 passed a bill changing the HSUS Puppy Mill Ballot Initiative, which is Proposition B. Voters passed that in the fall of 2010. Prop B would have placed harsh restrictions on dog breeders, limiting the number of breeding dogs they could have to 50. And contained language that agriculture said would have led to similar restrictions on livestock production in Missouri. Brownfield's Julie Harker followed that story.
The resulting legislation was called the Missouri Solution, which brought dog breeders, veterinarians, livestock producers, the state ag department, nearly all Missouri agriculture groups, and Governor Jay Nixon together to reform what they say needed to be reformed, and removed the severe restrictions that they say would have put legitimate dog breeders out of business. Gary Marshall is CEO of the Missouri Corn Growers Association.
Radical animal rights groups were trying to come into Missouri and tell us, you know, what we needed to do, first of all, on dogs, and then secondly, we think animal agriculture. And this really gives us an opportunity to work within Missouri to form a Missouri solution to this issue.
The legislation passed, but before Governor Nixon signed the bill, Missouri farmers, dog breeders, and others who supported the Missouri solution gathered on the Capitol lawn to support the bill, while animal rights supporters rallied at the governor's mansion to protest it. HSUS Ballot Campaigns Director Dane Waters said the agriculture language in the Puppy Mill Ballot Initiative did not apply to livestock, and in his words, the opposition got it wrong.
I don't want to say lies, but it's one of those things that the opposition is saying, which is just fundamentally false.
But Missouri Farmers Care spokesman Don Nicodem said not so fast.
They included domesticated animals in Prop B. That wasn't an accident. That's laying the groundwork for the future.
Nicodem said the group's track record of livestock-specific initiatives in other states and their stated goals of eliminating animal agriculture further reveal their true motives. But the HSUS did not stop with that defeat. It is working on a new ballot initiative in Missouri to require a 3/4 vote of the Missouri legislature to change any initiative statute. I'm Julie Harker.
Different states had different approaches to the situation. For livestock producers in Ohio, September 29, 2011 was a big day.
After 18 months of work, the director of the Ohio Department of Agriculture signed the final administrative order that put into effect the livestock care standards in Ohio. At the signing ceremony, Director Jim Zeringer called it a pivotal point in Ohio agriculture.
What's the message now to the livestock producers already here in Ohio with these standards in place?
There are some practices that may have to be looked at, but for the most part, the general practices of feed, water, transportation, euthanasia, a lot of these things they've been doing very well already. But if you're a veal farmer, you're going to have to look at maybe the tethering issue. If you're a hog farmer, in years to come, you'll have to look at the gestation crate removal.
Dr. Tony Forshee, state veterinarian in Ohio, told Brownfield that with the livestock care standards in place, other states have a template to go by.
I think we've set the pace and set the format for at least a template for what other states can use. Compliance is a key. We're not out there in enforcement side of things to put people in jail and fine them a bunch of dollars and things like that. We're here to get people to come into compliance, and we'll give them that opportunity.
And while a lot of time and effort was spent to developing the livestock care standards, Mike Bailey, executive director of the Livestock Care Standards Board, says it's now important to make sure livestock producers in Ohio understand what's required.
The key task before us still is to ensure we're getting the word out about these new standards and to make sure we're available to answer questions from producers as they arise.
Some experts think that Nebraska could be next on the list of the Humane Society of the United States. As Brownfield's Ken Anderson reports, tensions between the two sides intensified in 2011.
Fears that HSUS might make Nebraska its next target for a farm animal welfare ballot initiative caused farm groups and politicians in the Cornhusker state to close ranks in 2011. Several times during the year, Nebraska Governor Dave Heineman made it very clear that HSUS was not welcome in his state.
They are anti-agriculture, and they're out to destroy the number one industry in this state, and I'm not going to let them do it. We're going to stand up and fight. We will not be intimidated by these outsiders. We're going to defeat them.
HSUS President Wayne Pacelle fired back in an August interview with the Nebraska Radio Network.
I think that, you know, the people in Nebraska are smart enough to see past the rhetoric, whether it's Governor Heineman's rhetoric, which has been not helpful, or whether it's the Farm Bureau or others that have trotted out this false set of views of the Humane Society or this caricature of the Humane Society.
The next big development came in mid-October at a news conference in Lincoln. HSUS and the Nebraska Farmers Union announced the formation of a state livestock advisory council. Nebraska Farmers Union President John Hansen told Brownfield that in exchange for their cooperation, HSUS officials assured him that they would not pursue a ballot initiative.
That's one of the things we had to have, is that if you're not committed to backing off and giving this alternative approach a chance to succeed, then we can't stay at the table. And so we did get that assurance from them.
But instead of bringing peace, the announcement only seemed to fan the flames. Pete McClimate of WSA.
It is disturbing that somebody would reach out to groups that want to eliminate, if not restrict, animal agriculture like the animal rights groups.
So as the year comes to a close, the war of words between HSUS, Nebraska Livestock Groups, and Nebraska Governor Dave Heineman rages on. I'm Ken Anderson reporting.
In addition to attempts to influence legislatively at the ballot box, animal activist organizations promoted their objectives one day at a time. Brownfield's Megan Grebner takes this look at the other side of the coin.
Meatless Monday is an interesting concept. Take meat out of your diet one day a week to reduce your carbon footprint. While it may sound harmless, there is a lot more to that Meatless Monday campaign than you may think. Animal Ag Alliance Communication Director Sarah Hubbard.
What we need agricultural folks to understand and promote is that Meatless Monday really has a very serious vegan extreme agenda, and it's driven by a radical activist who is funding this group that is pushing it.
While the Animal Agriculture Alliance may be working to combat more subtle attacks on animal agriculture, Chris Ashworth, president of the Animal Ag Alliance and veterinarian, says it is very challenging to counter some of the more in-your-face stabs at the industry.
I'm very concerned about the undercover animal activists because it doesn't tell a true story of animal agriculture. What you end up seeing is you see young men or women who become employees of a farm or ranch or organization, even a processing plant. Once they become an employee, they start taking undercover video looking for inappropriate behaviors, and specifically I think one of the things that occurs is that you actually have some of the I dare you kind of issues, and that is the undercover activist dares an employee, another employee of the farm, to do something such as kicking an animal or striking an animal, which is inappropriate, is inhumane, and should not occur, but the undercover activist is filming that and wants to portray that to the American public as that being the norm or the standard.
Ultimately, Ashworth contends the battle between activist organizations and the agriculture industry is about permanently removing animal agriculture production from the United States. I'm Megan Grubner.
A door that was shut in 2007 to domestic horse slaughter in the United States was reopened in the fall of 2011. Here's more from Brownfield's Julie Harker.
In June, the General Accounting Office, the investigative arm of Congress, released a report on the impact of ending horse slaughter in the United States. It was titled, Action Needed to Address Unintended Consequences from Cessation of Domestic Horse Slaughter. The report confirmed what those in the horse world and agriculture had been saying all along. Without a market for horses, horses were suffering. The report said comprehensive national data are lacking, but state, local governments, and animal welfare organizations report a rise in investigations for horse neglect and more abandoned horses since 2007. The House Appropriations Committee then approved a bill with an amendment that would remove restrictions on USDA horse meat inspection, therefore reopening the door to horse processing. Those restrictions, according to the United Horsemen's Group, were included in backdoor meetings in 2007 at the urging of animal rights groups, such as the Humane Society of the United States, HSUS. The United Horsemen launched a campaign to drum up support to keep those riders out of the Senate Ag Appropriations Bill. In October, the Moran Amendment failed and the bill was passed. Without those riders or amendments that prevented USDA horse meat inspections, Dave Duquette with the United Horsemen said horse processing could reopen in the United States.
What it means is that we're going to be, somebody will be able to process horses right away.
Duquette says it's not about the money, as animal rights activists claim. It's about the horses. Sue Wallace, co-leader of United Horsemen and the International Equine Business Association, told Brownfield they have a network across the country looking for facilities for horse processing to resume because the states where it had previously taken place have banned horse slaughter.
Those facilities that are existing that are already processing large mammals and that could be relatively quickly retrofitted for the unique characteristics of horses.
Wallace contends that horse slaughter is humane.
The fact is that horses are processed exactly the same way that all other species of livestock and meat animals are processed. They have always been processed under the United States Humane Methods of Slaughter laws.
The Humane Society of the United States declined Brownfield's invitation for an interview about the resumption of horse slaughter. However, the animal rights group PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, came out in favor of lifting the horse slaughter ban. A post on PETA's blog says, to reduce horses' suffering, there must be a ban on exports of live horses together with a ban on slaughter in the United States. Or it doesn't work, never did, never will. There are still lawmakers who oppose resuming horse slaughter. Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill, who voted for the end of horse processing 5 years ago, says she would vote that way again.
I don't support the slaughtering of horses for domestic consumption, and I would vote again to oppose it if given the opportunity.
Missouri's other U.S. Senator, Roy Blunt, a Republican, says he is in favor of restoring the horse processing market, but seems to want it both ways. He told reporters that the lifting of the ban doesn't necessarily mean domestic slaughter will resume.
I'm not opposed to a better option for horse owners or the things that would make the horse industry a better industry, and I did vote for that bill, but that bill doesn't mean at all that you necessarily have slaughter facilities in the United States.
Nevertheless, Sue Wallace and the United Horsemen are moving forward. Wallace says it'll take a few years to get the market restored. I'm Julie Harker.
2011 was a good year for meat exports in the United States. Brownfield's Megan Grebner reports. One industry expert says the passage of the three free trade agreements with Colombia, South Korea, and Panama could mean good things for the U.S. meat industry.
Dan Hallstrom, Senior Vice President of Global Marketing with the U.S. Meat Export Federation, says exports in 2011 were something to notice.
I'll start with beef. We're up 26% through September, January through September of 2011, on 26% up on volume, 39% up on value. Some of the leading countries, in Middle East, South Korea, and Japan are leading the way there. And it's good news when you consider that we're doing this with some access opportunities still. So if we were to get a few things go our way on the access side in Japan or in China, for example, the number could be even better. So it really looks positive going forward on beef. On the pork side, we don't have nearly as many issues access related, but the numbers are good there as well. We're up 16% on volume and 25% on value, led there by the Hong Kong, China region, and Korea.
Hallstrom says while exports hit new records this year, U.S. agriculture is still a little behind when it comes to the trade game. But with the passage of the free trade agreements this year, there means an eventual increase in value.
We hoped to have this done a year or more ago, so there is some lost ground. But I think the key is that we've finally got it done. And in the case of beef, we're looking at duty reductions from 40% to zero over 15 years. And in the case of pork, we're going from 25% to zero over 4 years. So that's some dramatic impact immediately in terms of reduced duties and really increased value for the producer.
I'm Megan Grebner.
2011 saw more attention being paid to herbicide resistance issues. The discovery of 2,4-D-resistant water hemp in southeast Nebraska raised some eyebrows. Brownfield's Ken Anderson has more on that.
The Nebraska case is considered significant because it's the first reported instance of 2,4-D-resistant water hemp in the country, and it makes 2,4-D the sixth herbicide that water hemp has become resistant to in the U.S. University of Nebraska Lincoln Cropping System Specialist Greg Krueger says it appears to be an isolated case, but he says it does send a message about resistance management.
We caught this very early on. It's very isolated. I don't think it's something that we should panic about, but here's an opportunity for us to discuss what happened and really try to proactively manage the other areas that we're controlling weeds so that we don't have the same issue pop up in other places.
Although they haven't yet seen 2,4-D resistant water hemp, University of Illinois researchers say they have documented water hemp resistance to five other herbicide families in Illinois. I'm Ken Anderson reporting.
Stay tuned. There's more to come. You're listening to 2011, the year in review. From Brownfield, Ag News for America.